during all these travels and stuff like that, I met a lot of different craftspeople and a lot of different people that work with their hands and artists. And I thought, man, it'd be a really cool television show, you know, to showcase all these different people that make so many cool things, and to show people that, you know, craftsmanship is alive and well today. It's just, you don't really see that anymore. And, because, you know, oftentimes television is all about ratings and drama, and they don't give a shit about craftsmanship. They just want drama. They want yelling and screaming and arguing and fires and anything that, you know, captures attention. They don't really want to showcase craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, that'd be awesome to do that. So that's where the idea for Craftsman's Legacy started.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Eric, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it is really cool to have you here. So I was actually introduced to you by way of your publicist, who told me a bit about your story and the fact that you took a hobby, turned into a business, which subsequently was turned into a television show, all of which we will get into. But I want to start by asking, what did your parents do for a living, and how did that end up influencing the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, my mom was sort of a stay-at-home mom for a large part of my life. She worked as I got older, as my brother and I got a little older. And my dad was a bit of an entrepreneur himself. You know, he was really – he did all kinds of stuff, but oftentimes he had his own business in one way or the other. And – ultimately ended up as a financial consultant. Mm-hmm. So it was, I learned a lot, you know. I think the fact that my parents, my dad was always the guy that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you constantly have to put all your chips out on the table over and over and over again, you know, and then hopefully you get to a point where you don't have to do that as often and you can sort of hold back some of your chips. But my old man was sort of like the guy that just constantly put it all in. Everything he got into 100%, and he always went all in on everything. So, you know, as a kid, I got to see the pros and cons of that. You know, I got to see the good of it and the bad of it, you know, when businesses failed or, you know, something happened. I can remember my dad being unemployed, on and off over time. Mm-hmm. And you know, them having to sell things and, you know, churn money. And as a kid, you don't really know that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, like it really didn't impact my life directly all the time, but looking back at it now, I can tell that's exactly what was going on, you know. But my dad was also a very hands-on guy, and I think that's where I got my attitude towards working with your hands from, is from my dad and my grandfather, my mom's dad. Mm-hmm. He was a carpenter for a living. So
mm. And what about your mom?
My mom was a mom, you know. She was a great mom. She was pretty tough though. Like, she didn't put up with any BS. So, she was an awesome lady. She, rest in peace. Mm. I miss her very much. So,
how did the experience of seeing your dad kind of go from, you know, having money to not having money? How did that inform your entire perspective on money and the meaning of what your work would be later in your adult life?
I didn't really look at it that way, you know, like, because when I was a kid, first of all, around our house, like, we never ever hired anybody to do anything. It was super rare if there was a tradesman at the house, because my dad was really skilled. He was really mechanical, and my grandfather was too. So, you know, there wasn't anything around the house that we didn't handle ourselves. I mean, everything from cement work to, you know, brick work to roughing, finishing, you know, everything and anything we would handle ourselves. And it was really like very like specialized things, like installing carpet. You know, we would keep call a company in for that, but tile work we did ourselves. So growing up, and I loved doing that stuff. I loved working with my hands. I loved making things. And even as a super young kid, you know, 4 or 5 years old, I can remember, you know, my old man would give me some nails and a hammer and some chunks of 2x4 or 2x6 or, you know, 3/4 ply or whatever was laying around. And I would just nail stuff together, you know. And so that was really not an uncommon thing for me. And then as we got older, my dad was into landscaping, and he started a fertilizing company at a time when it was very it wasn't as regulated as it is today. So, you know, we had trucks at the house all the time for repair, and eventually he, you know, bought a nursery, and then had the, you know, had this company that was a nursery and lawn fertilizing and landscaping and the whole thing. And I worked there, you know, on Saturdays, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm like 8 years old, but my job was, cutting, firewood in the fall and in the winter, with, you know, chainsaws and lawn splitters. And then, in the summertime, I worked there more often, and it was, you know, helping customers and carrying shrubs and, you know, whatever I could drag along as an 8 to 10 year old boy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot about hard work, you know, and that nothing's free, and that you get what you put in. You know what I mean? The harder you work, the more you get out. And that still carries through to me today. You know, I think I've always had a very strong work ethic, and that's one of the things that I really got from my parents the most, is to don't ever give up and don't let anybody else tell you what you can and cannot do.
Mm-hmm. So walk me through how you get to the point of a craftsman's legacy. Like, walk me through the journey from, you know, your actual career to how you ended up here.
Sure. So it's a bit of a long-winded story, but originally, you know, I was never really good in school when I was a kid. I just never applied myself. I didn't care for it much. I found it really boring, and I fell behind in classes. And then, you know, I was a slacker in schoolwork, you know what I mean? So when college was coming around, you know, my grades were horrible. And I started working for Xerox when I was 16 as a stock boy. And I went to community college a little bit after I graduated, but I stayed at Xerox, and I was literally, you know, eventually I wasn't a stock boy, and I started making copies, and I was, you know, moving on up, but I was making copies. And, but I always wanted to continue to move up in the company. So, you know, over time I would get into different positions and different things, but, the biggest change happened when I was there, Xerox was moving from an analog environment to a digital environment. So instead of a photocopy, it was a scanned and printed image, you know? And I was a computer geek. I was way into computers when I was a kid. And even when we couldn't afford them, you know, there was some at school, and my friends had them, and eventually my parents got me one when I was younger, and I was really, really into computers. So when Xerox transitioned into this environment, I was familiar with Unix at that time, and they had all this equipment laying there, and I just set it up one night and, you know, was playing around with it and stuff. And I was working nights, and I was just screwing around with those computer systems all the time. So I was at the right place at the right time, and they needed, you know, somebody with a technical background. And I didn't have the schooling that all the other applicants had, but I had the passion, the interest, and I'd been with the company by that time for a little bit. And so they gave the job to me, and I became a tech consultant. And I traveled around a lot more and got more involved with, you know, all kinds of different things within Xerox. And I liked it. I really, really enjoyed it. It was a lot of problem solving. And, you know, it was just a fun time, you know, to be at that company. A lot of fun. Everything's moving along great. And then all of a sudden I start developing a panic disorder. And the very first attack I had, I was scuba diving with my brother in Bonaire. And I was about 80 feet down, and I had a panic attack. I didn't know what it was at the time, but it scared the hell out of me, you know, and I literally, you know, shot up to the surface. And I was able to control my breathing a little bit and realize to stop, you know, around 25, 30 feet to let the nitrogen out of my bloodstream, you know? And then I went up to the top, and I didn't know what the hell happened, you know, but it was something I didn't enjoy. And it shipped me up, you know, so I did a little bit more diving on that trip, and I came home. And then shortly after that, a couple months later, I had to fly down to Texas for Xerox. And when I was down there, I started having a lot of attacks on a very regular basis. Like, you know, I was having more and more and more of them. And then when I got home from that trip, you know, after that, I didn't fly for another 5 years, you know, and the attacks got to the point where, my world started to shrink at a very rapid pace. So in a matter of 4 months, I went from just being, you know, a regular dude in his 20s to being pretty much agoraphobic. You know, I didn't leave my house. I was on disability with the company, and was heavily medicated to the point where cutting my lawn was an all day event because I couldn't concentrate long enough to do anything, you know? So, you know, my world got sort of dark at that time in some ways, you know, cause you don't know what the hell's going on. You think you're going to die, you know, quite honestly, you think you're having a heart attack, you know, three times a day, four times a day, or, you know, you're freaking out, you know, and I'm not I don't like taking a lot of pills, especially those kind of pills, because they really alter your state of mind and your body and everything else. So, I was very resistant to it until I got taken to the hospital, and then they don't give you a choice there. They just sort of start popping you full of stuff to calm you down. So, so when that happened to me, I spent a lot of time working on motorcycles. I had motorcycles myself, and I loved riding, and I loved working on them. I liked the mechanical aspect of them. I really wanted to get into learning more about them, learning how to build them, you know, how to shape metal to make something, you know, to make a fuel tank or anything. And, as I started to get back on the road and recover and get back to, you know, living a normal life, leaving my house, driving, all the normal things that people do, I found a metal shaper who lived right by my house. He wasn't far away at all. And I had already owned his books and read them. For some reason, the whole dots didn't connect for me initially. And, so I met Ron Fournier, and I would go over there. And after about a year of going over there on a regular basis, saying hi and, you know, talking to him and getting to know each other, we became friends, you know, and he was older, but he took a shining to me. You know, he did that with a lot of people. You know, anybody that was really interested in metalworking, he'd sort of take you in and help you learn. So he said, hey, you know, I'm looking for a new apprentice. And so I took that job and started sweeping floors. And he taught me how to TIG weld properly and gas weld properly and how to shape metal and, you know. And then his business took a turn for the worse. And he said, well, I got to let you go. And I said, well, how about if I work here for free? I'll help you out as long as you keep teaching me. And so we struck up that deal. And he said, you know, if you want to sell some services yourself, build motorcycle parts and use our equipment here, you could do that at night. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. He said, I'll, you know, guide you and help you how I can. And that went on like that for a little while, you know, and then, I started Voodoo Choppers, you know, when I was, you know, really, really bad off, a friend of mine actually said to me, he said, what, you know, if you could do anything with your life and money didn't matter and skills didn't matter, what would you do? And I said, I'd make things. And, he was like, well, what would you make? And I said, I don't know. I like working with wood, but I'd really like to learn how to work with metal. I like flames. You know, I love torches and things like that. And, he was like, well, maybe that's what you need to be doing, you know, stop fighting everything else and just don't worry about it. Just do what makes you feel right and feel good, you know, gives you a sense of purpose, I guess. So the story's a little out of order there in some ways, but that's sort of how it all came down. So I started Voodoo Choppers, and, you know, Ron and I worked together for a couple of years at his place and then over at my place. He shut down his business and I rented out a commercial space, which quite frankly was completely ridiculous because I had very little business coming in. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And, I was growing out of my shop, my home shop, you know, I wanted more equipment. I wanted to do more things. I didn't have the space. And, my dad pushed me and he said, go find a commercial building and rent it. And I didn't have the money. I took a loan out, dude, for, $20,000. And, I rented a space and bought equipment and opened up Voodoo Choppers. And, I drove around and cold called. I took my wares, you know, I took a fender and a fuel tank and stuff like that. I take it to different bike shops and I'd say, hey, this is what I do. I'm not selling parts. I'm not, you know, impeding on your business in any way, but I want to help you. I want to, you know, do you have any, projects that might need, a special, you know, fuel tank or a fender? And at this time, you know, this was in 99, 2000 timeframe. So, in the motorcycle industry, the aftermarket was huge, you know, aftermarket, meaning you could go to a shop, open up a catalog and build an entire motorcycle from aftermarket parts, not, you know, OEM parts, but, you get fuel tanks and fenders and everything else, but there wasn't a whole lot of people, that were hand making fuel tanks and fenders, like there is today, you know? So I had a lot of no's, all but one actually, one guy said, yeah, I'm working on a bike for myself. I'd love to do that. And, you know, I took a beating on price, but I did the work and I learned a lot. And that's how that started, you know, and then things just went from there. You know, I was at the shop all the time, 7 days a week, all the time, 12, 14 hour days. And it was like that for, you know, quite some time. First few years, I was like that. And I reinvested into the company. You know, I just bought more and more equipment, more machinery. I wanted to be able to do everything myself. I didn't want to have to hire out, you know, or the only thing I didn't want to do was paint. So I don't like chemicals and composite materials and stuff like that. I just don't like dealing with them. I don't dig it. Mm. Everything else I just went after myself, you know. And we got to do biker build off in the mid-2000s was pretty popular, and we got invited to do a biker build off show on Discovery Channel, and I loved doing that. That was awesome. It was massive. And that didn't, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, you were on TV, like, you know, people must be beating down the door to get to you. And that wasn't really the case. But what it did do was bring name recognition. More people knew of Voodoo Choppers. More people had heard of the shop and my name. So that brought credibility, you know, and started to build a reputation outside of Michigan. And outside of the Detroit area for me. So it just sort of built from there, you know, and it was literally one penny at a time type of thing. I can remember I was traveling. We used to do a ton of shows, and, I was traveling home from, I don't know, somewhere. And, there was three of us in the car. I had no money. Like, I had just enough money to get gas to get us home, but no money for food, nothing else. And, I, you know, scrounged up some change in the truck, and, literally, like, you know, I don't know, $7 or something like that, or $6, or I forget exactly how much it was, but it was just a handful of change, man. And we pull up in there, and we went to a McDonald's. It was late at night, you know, dark out. And I go in to start ordering a couple things off the dollar menu. And the manager walked up to me and he goes, hey, man, those guys built some badass bikes. And I said, well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And I had a Voodoo hat on, and I forgot I had a Voodoo hat on, or maybe with my jacket or something. He's like, Voodoo, man, those guys build badass bikes. Do you have one? And I said, no, I own the company. And he goes, get out of town. Are you kidding me? And I said, no. He goes, man, I didn't even recognize you. I saw that show and blah, blah. He went nuts, man. And I'll tell you what, that guy saved my ass, because he was like, order what you want. Will you take some pictures and sign some autographs? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we were able to get a couple more dollar menu items. You know, I didn't take advantage of the situation, but I definitely got a couple of cheeseburgers, you know. But yeah, you know, it was just crazy, man. It's like, you know, there's plenty of opportunity to say no more, but you just got to keep at it and keep hammering away. So to get to your question about how Legacy started, during all these travels and stuff like that, I met a lot of different craftspeople and a lot of different people that work with their hands and artists. And I thought, man, it'd be a really cool television show, you know, to showcase all these different people that make so many cool things, and to show people that, you know, craftsmanship is alive and well today. It's just, you don't really see that anymore. And because, you know, oftentimes television is all about ratings and drama, and they don't give a shit about craftsmanship. They just want drama. They want yelling and screaming and arguing and fires and anything that, you know, captures attention. They don't really want to showcase craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, that'd be awesome to do that. So that's where the idea for Craftsman's Legacy started. Mm.
This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Sunbasket. All right, my healthy seeking friends, the days of not following through with resolutions are over, because the days of Sunbasket are just beginning, which means you're going to keep your resolutions this year because Sunbasket makes it easier than ever. And today you can get $35 off your first order when you go to sunbasket.com/creative. When you have healthy meals regularly delivered to your door with Sunbasket, it's easy to stay on track. I'm talking ingredients like organic produce, responsibly raised meats, sustainably sourced fish, organic pasture raised eggs, and organic non-GMO tofu. Oh, and house-made sauces that you can't find anywhere else. And it's all personalized. Sunbasket lets you mix and match from paleo, lean and clean, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, and more. Not to mention tons of variety with 18 recipes to choose from each week. Best of all, each delicious, easy recipe is ready in about 30 minutes. With Sunbasket, you have total flexibility. You can cancel at any time, skip any time, and choose any meal plan you want. Go to sunbasket.com/creative today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/creative for $35 off. Again, that's sunbasket.com/creative.
Wow. Okay. So many questions come from this. You know, the period in which you started to have the panic attacks and sort of become agoraphobic, how did you not lose hope during that period?
Oh, hell, I did, man. Many times.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, hell yeah, many times. I thought I was going to be crazy the rest of my life, dude. Like, honestly, I didn't know what the hell was going to happen to me. It wasn't day by day. It was hour by hour, man. It was like, you know, because what happens is that, you know, you're walking through life and you're going to the grocery store. You have a panic attack at the grocery store. Not going there anymore. You're driving along. You have a panic attack on I-75. Got to stay off I-75. You know, I mean, that's what starts happening to you. So you start having attacks and you associate a place with that attack or a feeling with that attack or a sense, you know, like it's cold outside or it's hot or whatever. You know, you start having these associations in your head that's what's triggering the attack. And that's the last thing you want to do. You're like, don't want to do that anymore. That scared the shit out of me. So you stop going to those places. And then soon enough, like I said, literally within 4 months, I was very agoraphobic to the point where I didn't eat by myself. Somebody would have to come and have a meal with me. I didn't like, you know, I had a great fear of choking. So eventually my meals just became shakes, milkshakes. I had milkshakes all the time. And, you know, occasionally I'd have like a sandwich or a grilled cheese sandwich. I lost about 45 pounds. So I weighed about 140 pounds, like in the deep of it, you know, and I'm 6'4" or five. Mm. So I'm a pretty big guy to weigh 140 pounds, you know. Mm-hmm. I see pictures of myself back then and it's pretty messy. You know, my eyes are real sunken and
yeah,
I was, you know, not the healthy staple that I am today. Like I was.
So in those early days, two questions about it. One, do you think that there's something in particular about working with your hands that helped you navigate this challenging period? And then the other thing that I think was really interesting is you said, you know, like the first customer that you had, you kind of, you know, you didn't even really make money on it. Like in that moment when you've, you know, taken out a $20,000 loan and you're struggling just to find customers, like you got, literally you got nothing but no's and just one yes. Like how do you persist during those periods?
Because you want it. You know, persistence is really the key. You know what I mean? Like it really truly is persistence. Everything in life is about persistence. You know, if you can't understand or get to the point in life where you realize that, you know, it's pretty rare when somebody just walks up to you and says, hey, here you go. Here's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you got to be willing to go out there and just be persistent, not be mean, just persistent. Like, not every, you're not going to fit everybody. And I tell people that today, you know, like, I'm not for everybody. I'm not the right builder for everybody, for everything. You know, I had a guy walk in the other day, asked me, he wanted some stuff made. And he said he kept using the word cheap, cheap, cheap. And I said, dude, I don't know how you got to my shop, but that's not a word that's really thrown around here. Like, that, I'm not known for that. And it's not because, I'm not fair and equitable, but I'm not cheap. I'm not a cheap builder, you know, like it's expensive what we do because we work with our hands and things take time, you know, and it's just sort of how it is, you know, but, it's all about persistence. Yeah. Yeah. You get constantly kicked, you know, I mean, there's nothing, I always say, you know, when you're going after something that you really wanted, you know, something you believe in and you're going after it, you're going to find a whole bunch of people that are going to tell you why you can't do it and that you shouldn't do it and that it's a bad idea and that you can't do it. There's going to be an endless amount of people that are going to tell you that. But that doesn't, you know, it's not always something you need to listen to. You know, if you believe in yourself and you believe that you can do it, you'll find a way to get it done. Mm-hmm.
So let's spend the rest of our time talking about this sort of notion of craft and working with our hands. One, you know, why is it so rewarding? What actually goes into it? Like, what do people who are masters of their craft in the various areas you've seen, like, what do they have in common that allows them to be so good at what they do? And what can people who are listening take away from that?
Again, persistence is huge. The willingness to learn from mistakes is another thing. You know, you asked me, like, what was it about working with my hands that allowed me to, that helped me? And every single craftsman that we've had on the show and that I've talked to will tell you the same thing. You know, when you are creating and you're working with your hands, and you know, whether you're working with wood or you're, you know, creating on a computer or what, you sort of find this place in time, you know, and your mind sort of goes there, and you get into this, it's like your own world, you know, your only goal at that moment is to do what you're doing and create and make it better than it was last time you did it. And that's what's driving you, you know, and it's not about knowing everything or knowing all the answers. It's about learning and understanding the opportunities to learn. You know, that was a huge thing in my career as a metal shaper was, when do you stop working on a piece? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that everybody that we've had on the show would also tell you that, you know, you have to understand when it's time to stop working on that piece and move on to a new piece, you know, because as an artist or as a craftsman, you're trying to gain perfection, right? You want it to be perfect. You want it to be fully symmetrical. You want it to be like, you know, you want it to look like a machine made it, like it's just absolute perfection. But that's not obtainable. You know, when you're creating by hand, perfect symmetry, perfect perfection is not obtainable. There's always blemishes. There's always an area that you might not be 100% satisfied with. And that's sort of part of working with your hands. Mm-hmm. You know, but as you become better at things, that amount of blemish or that amount of symmetry starts to diminish, and eventually it'll get to a point where you know where the problem areas are, but nobody else would ever see it. Mm-hmm. You know,
Yeah.
I don't know if I answer your question.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it reminds me quite a bit of the process of writing a book in a lot of ways.
Sure. Yeah, sure. You know, because, you know, you're lost in your own space, you know, and that's a great place to be. And that's what's, you know, really helped me out over time is that ability to find that moment and get lost in that moment. And sometimes it's hard, you know, sometimes it's really hard because you got a million other things on your plate. You know, your to-do list is like overflowing with stuff that you should be doing or you're supposed to be doing. But sometimes what you really need to be doing is making things or creating, at least for me, because it really helps me understand things better and put things in perspective, you know? Mm-hmm.
This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by Skillshare. It's January, which means you're probably still thinking about your New Year's resolution. While many people have resolved to go on a diet, hit the gym, or call mom more often, our sponsor Skillshare encourages listeners to use 2018 to learn new skills and make this year their best year yet. Skillshare is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in design, business, technology, and more. Whether you're trying to deepen your professional skill set, start a side hustle, or just explore something new, Skillshare will keep you learning in 2018 and beyond. Some of my personal favorite classes have been taught by former Unmistakable Creative podcast guest. Simon Sinek has an amazing course titled Presentation Essentials, How to Share Ideas That Inspire Action. And it's one of those courses that I've watched and even applied to my own presentations as a speaker. And just in time for the new year, Skillshare is offering the Unmistakable Creative podcast listeners a limited time offer of 3 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to skillshare.com/create99. Again, go to skillshare.com/create99 to get 3 months of Skillshare for only 99 cents. Act now for this special New Year's offer and start learning today.
So, being at the point where this has turned into a TV show, has it changed your relationship with your work at all? Like where you have this sort of stature and notoriety?
No, I think I understand what you're asking me, but I don't really look at it like that. Like I'm the only difference between me now and me, you know, 10 years ago is that I'm probably a little bit better craftsman. But you know, I still struggle all the time with things, you know, and everything, you know what I mean? So, the impact for working with my hands has been that I can't bring on as much work as I used to, you know, now I have to be, I'm a way more selective about the work and I just tell people up front, like, listen, dude, this is what I got going on right now. But, you know, if you're still interested in, you know, 6 months or 4 months or however far out it is, please let me know. And I'm more than happy to help you. And if you're not, if you have to go somewhere else, that's totally cool. I get it. But I don't want to upset people. You know what I mean? Like you bring in too much work and then you can't get it done, man. It just makes everybody mad. Mm-hmm. And then it puts a ton of pressure on you. You know what I mean? Cause I feel horrible missing deadlines or, you know, not making a deadline. That's a terrible feeling to call somebody up and say, hey dude, I know I said your bike was going to be done, this month, but I'm way behind. Mm. I hate that. I hate doing that. But it happens.
One other question for you. I mean, it's interesting. We're talking about craft and the value of making things with our hands. And yet, you know, what's interesting is that seems to be less and less part of our world as we get through, you know, to like automation and technology. So like, what are the implications of all of that for people who are craftsmen?
Well, it's a much bigger implication, on us as a society than just for craftsmen. You know, craftsmen understand, I believe, you know, we understand the value of handmade things, mm-hmm. right? We understand what it means and what it has and what that item is. But when, you know, we're at a point now where everything is very limited lifespan and and an instant gratification. You know what I mean? Like, you can go online and order anything. You can buy anything you want online. You don't have to wait. Sometimes you don't even have to wait a day, you know? You can get stuff the same day online. That's ridiculous, you know? But it really, I think, messes with our perception of value in time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're losing so many skills and so much knowledge we're losing because it's not being passed on, because there's nobody there to pass it on to necessarily. Sometimes there's nobody there to pass the information on to, and then that information dies with that person that has it. You know, a craftsman's a key holder in a way. You know, it's their responsibility to make sure that knowledge moves on to the next generation or to another group of people so that they can keep that alive. Mm-hmm. You know, think about how many things that we've lost in time because there was nobody there to pass it on to, you know, or somebody didn't want to pass it on to because they thought it was their proprietary knowledge, you know, that kind of bullshit. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a big fan of that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this has been really, really fascinating and interesting. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What do I think it is that makes somebody unmistakable?
Or something unmistakable?
Well, that's a good question. I think everybody's unmistakable. I really do. Like, I think we as people have gotten to a point where we just put up so many roadblocks in our lives, and we don't even know we're doing it, you know? And it's not necessary. So many people are like, oh man, I wish I could do that. I'm like, dude, you totally can do that. All you got to do is put some time into it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that's out of your reach, you know? And to me, that's what makes us unmistakable. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with the listeners. Where can people learn more about the work that you do?
So online, you can go to craftsmanslegacy.com for the television show, and you can watch free episodes and all that jazz. There's plenty of branded merchandise up there too. And then you can find out about Voodoo Choppers at voodoochoppers.com, and, you know, social media, you can follow both brands and myself on social media, you know, or you can reach out and call. A lot of people just call.
Awesome.
Which is cool. Or they stop by the shop.
Very cool. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.